piece of truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear Graham McQueen's speech given at the March 26, 2011 Investigate Building 7 conference at the University of Hartford. Graham McQueen is a retired Canadian professor of peace studies. His full bio can be found at the website investigatebuilding7.org. He's been doing research on 9/11 for several years now. Building 7 is also known as the Solomon Brothers Building. And here's Graham McQueen.
It's a great honor to share the podium with so many wonderful speakers and individuals. My topic today is foreknowledge of World Trade Center 7's collapse, but I was asked to say a couple of words first about the building in general. I think most of you know this, but it won't hurt to go through it. I won't spend too much time, just to locate you in the right spot. We are, after all, talking about a specific building today, and the collapse of that building. It is an important collapse, not just to architects and engineers. In terms of political history, I would say this is probably one of the most important building collapses in modern history, certainly worth our day's study. So here's where it's located. This picture is taken obviously from the air and somewhat to the south. The tall building closest to you is World Trade 2, the South Tower. Then World Trade 1, the North Tower with the big aerial on top. And then across Vesey Street is our building, World Trade 7. It was about 350 feet from the north side of the North Tower. Here's a shot from the north, South Tower in the distance, then the North Tower, and then our building, World Trade 7. 7 was 47 stories high, as you've heard, 650 feet, a big building by the standards of most of us from the towns and cities that most of us come from. Each floor had about the same area as a football field, so it's a large building. This building was not struck by a plane. It did suffer some damage when the North Tower came down. Here you see this enormous steel structure called the North Tower, which has been reduced to rapidly moving cloud of pulverized material, and 7 is standing in the midst of it. It also suffered fires on the day, which you can see here. And just before 5:21 in the afternoon, there was a little tremor of the earth, which registered as a seismic signal, and 10 seconds later, the building came down. You've seen it before, this collapse. You'll probably see it many times today, but it's definitely worth looking at more than once. 10 seconds after, the earth shook. Now, it took the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is an agency of the U.S. Department of Commerce, quite a few years to come up with its final report. But finally, in 2008, they came up with their final report on the collapse of this building. Insofar as we can talk about an official story about the collapse of World Trade 7, it would be the story found in this report. So you'll find us, the three speakers this afternoon, all referring to this report. We'll call the National Institute of Standards and Technology NIST, because it's easier to say. And we'll be talking about this particular report when we refer to the NIST report. The gist, as William Pepper just said, the gist of their conclusion is that this building came down in the way that you just observed because of office fires. Many, many people reject that explanation, including all the speakers today. That is, all the speakers certainly this afternoon. Many of us think that this building came down because it was intentionally and skillfully brought down on 9/11. In other words, it was subjected to controlled demolition. I imagine most of you here have heard this claim before. Some of you may still find it outrageous. The implications of it, if we're right, are of course huge. We would then have to say why we all been lied to for 9.5 years. We would have to ask what else may have gone on that day that we don't know about. How about those other buildings that collapsed? What about 9/11 as a whole? What about the global war on terror? Now, we're not going to explore those wide, wide important questions today. We're going to focus on 7, Building 7. But I did want to mention them to you, because that's the context in which we study this building, and that's why it's one of the most important building collapses in modern history. Now, that's my little intro to Building 7, and I now want to move into my specific topic. And to do that, I am going to begin by showing you the way Building 7's collapse was dealt with by the BBC.
Now, more on the latest building collapse in New York. You might have heard a few moments ago I was talking about the Salomon Brothers building collapsing, and indeed it has. Apparently that's only a few hundred yards away from where the World Trade Center towers were. And it seems that this was not a result of a new attack. It was because the building had been weakened during this morning's attacks. We'll probably find out more now about that from our correspondent, Jane Stanley. Jane, what more can you tell us about the Salomon Brothers building and its collapse?
Well, only really what you already know. Details are very, very sketchy. There's almost a sense downtown in New York behind me, down by the World Trade Centers, of just an area completely closed off as the rescue workers try to do their job. But this isn't the first building that has suffered as a result. We know that part of the Marriott Hotel next to the World Trade Center also collapsed as a result of this huge amount of falling debris from 110 floors of the two twin towers of the World Trade Center. As you can see behind me, the Trade Center appears to be still.
We'll cut off Jane Stanley there. Jane Stanley talks for about 7 minutes altogether. After 7 minutes, her image breaks up, and the anchor says, "Unfortunately, I think we've lost the line with Jane Stanley." In the meantime, however, we have those remarkable 7 minutes. Two things I want to note. First of all, the red arrow shows you the caption at the bottom, which confirms what she's saying, the 47-story Salomon Brothers building. That's another name for World Trade 7. Close to the World Trade Center has also collapsed. And of course, the second thing that's worth noting is that the building is standing behind her the entire time she's speaking. World Trade Center 7 has not collapsed, nor is it collapsing, nor will it collapse till over 20 minutes after its collapse was announced. Now, when this little video clip from the BBC was rediscovered and posted on the internet in 2007, it raised a lot of controversy, firestorm of debate and dialogue, and the BBC received many letters of complaint and query, to which finally they felt an obligation to respond. So the head of news for BBC World said the following: "We're not part of a conspiracy. Nobody told us what to say or do on September the 11th. We didn't get told in advance that buildings were going to fall down. If we reported the building had collapsed before it had done so, it would have been an error. No more than that." Well, perhaps your laughter indicates that I don't need to analyze that too much more, but I will anyway, because that's what academics do. They go on and on, even when it's not necessary. They flog dead horses. So let's just think about that claim. It was just an error and nothing more. Suppose one of the organizers of this event were to pop up right now and say, "Unfortunately, Graham McQueen fell and hurt his knee on the way here today, and that's why he's just collapsed and died." Hopefully some of you would point out that I haven't collapsed and died. I'm here. Well, then we would have to ask, what kind of a peculiar situation was that? What do we make of that announcement? Now, so far, we probably would agree that it was an error, albeit a bizarre error. It's a bizarre error, not only because I'm still standing, but because hurting your knee doesn't normally lead to you collapsing and dying. Nonetheless, we might pass it off. But supposing 20 minutes later I did collapse and die at the podium, then the situation has completely changed, hasn't it? Now, we still have error. There was an error in the timing of the announcement. But we also have tremendous accuracy. We have truth being communicated. And when I say tremendous accuracy, that's because my collapsing and dying could not apparently have been predicted through what happened to me. You see the point? If you were a police investigator trying to figure out why I collapsed and died, don't you think you'd have some pretty tough questions for that person who popped up and said I had already collapsed and died? Now, some of you may think it's a bad analogy, because after all, people don't normally die when they hurt their knee, whereas this building was clearly on fire, and surely that's a more natural thing to expect its collapse. But it isn't. You've been told this before, but I'm going to say it again. This direct quotation from the NIST report, you should paste on your foreheads. It's so important. This was the first known instance of the total collapse of a tall building primarily due to fires. We could put it more powerfully. This is the first time in history that a building like this has come down from fires. This is a unique, unprecedented, and therefore unpredictable event. So if it was fishy to somehow think I was going to collapse and die because I hurt my knee, it was even fishier to expect that this building would come down simply because it was on fire. Now, I want to stop and make a little distinction here. It may be a bit pedantic and unnecessary, but I want to take my time with this. If you were that police investigator looking into my death, you would be asking tough questions, because at some point you would understand the difference between two types of foreknowledge. One we might call evidence-based foreknowledge, and the other we might call action-based foreknowledge. Evidence-based foreknowledge is when you see something, you observe something, study it, measure it, whatever, and you find evidence that rationally leads you to conclude that something for sure is going to happen. You gain your foreknowledge through the study of the evidence. Action-based foreknowledge is when you know something's going to happen because you're darn well going to make it happen. It's the human will and human action that brings it about. Now, that's quite a common form of foreknowledge. We know about things that are going to happen in the future because we're going to do them, or people we know are going to do them. There's nothing inherently fishy about it, but it becomes fishy when we pretend it's something else. So the investigator, looking into my death, would consider the possibility that the person that said I'd already collapsed was maybe an extremely skilled physician, good at prognosis, sees all the signs, knows I'm going to die, and just jumps the gun a little. That would be a legitimate evidence-based foreknowledge. But the investigator will also consider the possibility that perhaps the person who talked about me collapsing had poisoned my coffee that morning. In other words, had done something which led them to know that was going to happen. Excuse me for having to kind of go through these distinctions, but they're important, because my main contention, my argument, is that NIST has tried again and again and again, first of all, to ignore the foreknowledge of Building 7, but when it finds itself unable to avoid the topic, it tries to present it all as prognosis, as the evidence-based estimation that something is going to happen. Whereas I'm claiming it can't be. The evidence is such that that cannot be true. That what is true is that it's action-based foreknowledge. People knew that building was coming down because somebody had determined to bring it down. That's my argument. My conclusion is that NIST's 2008 collapse hypothesis is incompatible with the evidence of foreknowledge that we possess, and that NIST has repeatedly denied and tried to obfuscate, tried to blur that evidence in order to maintain its hypothesis. I further want to affirm, although I won't be able to have time to argue this in detail here, that I've looked at other hypotheses as well, the ones that existed before 2008, and the only collapse hypothesis that I have found that's compatible with this foreknowledge is the action-based hypothesis. They knew, people knew this building was coming down because somebody was going to bring it down. And that's where the knowledge came from. And that's why I say only the controlled demolition hypothesis is compatible with this evidence of foreknowledge. Now, there's one more stage in my talk today. I'm sure there are some of you, particularly those of you who are encountering this discussion for the first time, who are thinking, well, you know, that foreknowledge is certainly weird, and it doesn't seem to fit very well with the government hypothesis. But McQueen seems to be going a little too quickly to controlled demolition. You know, couldn't there be some other explanation? Well, first of all, you're going to be hearing from other speakers today, and they will make the case, different parts of the case, and they'll make it more comprehensive than I have done. I'm giving you one piece of the puzzle. However, I'm going to start you off on the next stage of our thinking about this by looking very briefly at three types of witness evidence. And I think when you've seen these witnesses, you'll realize that there are many reasons why we gravitate to the controlled demolition hypothesis. And I'm giving these in this talk because each one of them supports the claim I've been making that foreknowledge indicates controlled demolition. So we can get to these witnesses that I'm going to present quite briefly to you today by asking three questions. First of all, were there any authorities on the scene on 9/11 before the collapse of World Trade 7 who said that bringing the building down deliberately was an option, was being discussed on 9/11? In other words, if say, firefighters were standing around saying, well, maybe we'll have to bring it down, that would mean we would have no choice but to consider the controlled demolition as a possible hypothesis. And the second question that we would want to ask is, are there any insiders, anybody, are there people with inside knowledge who said after 9/11 that we did bring it down? That would be nice to know. And thirdly, are there any witnesses who claim to have experienced explosions in World Trade 7? And the answer to all three questions is yes. I will be going through them briefly because I don't want to go on too long today. We start with the first issue. Is there evidence that controlled demolition was being discussed as a possibility before this building came down? Now, this witness, Indira Singh, was a senior consultant for J.P. Morgan Chase, and on 9/11 was working as a voluntary emergency medical worker. She was interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner in 2005 on Guns and Butter, and this little short excerpt is from that.
All I can attest to is that by noon or 1 o'clock, they told us we had to move from that triage site up to Pace University, a little further away, because Building 7 was going to come down or being brought down.
Did they actually use the word brought down, and who was it that was telling you this?
The fire department, and they did use the word, we're going to have to bring it down.
That's a remarkable statement. So, question, is there any corroborating evidence? Has any other witness said the same thing? Yes. This next footage is live from MSNBC, right after the collapse of World Trade 7. Fascinating clip.
All right, we're going to have to move this way. We're going to have to move. That cloud is coming this way.
Yeah. Actually, get out of there. Leave the camera on, man, if you need to and get out of there. What we've been fearing all afternoon has apparently happened. We were watching number 7 World Trade, which was part of the ancillary damage of the explosion and collapse of the other two. We've been talking all day about how fast these plumes of smoke move. You're watching one on the move right now that is building dust. Look at the wider shot on the left from across the river in New York. This was a 40-story building they've been watching all day. This is like watching the collapse of an active volcano. And the dust from it is not unlike that from a volcano. We are on the phone with New York Fire Department Lieutenant David Restuccio. Lieutenant, where are you right now?
I'm at the corner of Northmore Street and Greenwich Street.
Can you confirm it was number 7 that just went in?
Yes,
sir. And you guys knew this was coming all day.
We had heard reports that the building was unstable and that eventually we need to come down on its own or it would be taken down. I would imagine it came down on its own.
I might assume you heard those last few words, but I'm going to read them again anyway. TV anchor, you guys knew this was coming all day. Isn't that remarkable? You knew this was coming all day. All day long, you've known this building is going to come down. That's foreknowledge again, and it shows that the news station had gotten information of this sort. Restuccio gives a very careful reply. We had heard reports that the building was unstable, and that eventually it would either come down on its own or it would be taken down. I would imagine it came down on its own. In other words, if I could reword Restuccio's last statement, this building has just utterly and completely collapsed. I guess it's probably a gravity-driven collapse, but it might be controlled demolition, because that was discussed during the day. So we have two highly credible witnesses who say that this was discussed as an option during the day. We now move to our next question, and you've already seen Silverstein, but it won't hurt to see him again, of Silverstein Development Corporation that owned Building 7. And I think we need to turn up the sound of this.
Pelted by debris when the North Tower collapsed, 7 burned until late afternoon, allowing occupants to evacuate to safety.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
Right. Many of you have already seen that clip, and perhaps it's not necessary for me to discuss it at length. It's not surprising that people took his comments about pulling to refer to removing, getting rid of, demolishing the building. Silverstein later said that all he meant was that they should pull firefighters out of the building or of the area. Many people, including me, reject that explanation. However, we don't have time to get into the details of that debate here. Because we're talking about the kind of investigation that NIST did, let's just ask whether they had tough questions for Mr. Silverstein. And I believe it's Manny who already told us just how tough those questions were. They accepted immediately his explanation that he'd referred to pulling people out of the building. And when I think it was Lori Van Auken asked Sunder directly if they had interviewed Silverstein, he basically said, we didn't interview him and we don't intend to. So much, my friends, for tough questions, and so much for a serious investigation of the collapse of World Trade 7. And I move on to my last witness. Were there any people who actually experienced explosions in World Trade 7? And there were several. The most famous is Barry Jennings. Because my time is just about over, I'm going to show you only a very brief clip so you'll see who Barry Jennings was on 9/11 itself. And then I'll explain why his testimony is important.
For the past couple of minutes, it has been clear from this space back on Chambers in that area. So now they're walking back toward the World Trade Center. And as we keep letting you hear the personal stories, the survivor stories of exactly what happened inside the World Trade Center when that first plane went in, and of course the collapses since then, we're going to bring more of those to you now. Barry Jennings, you're on the 8th floor, you work for the City Housing Department. Explain to me the moment of impact.
Well, me and Mr. Hess, Corporation Council, were on the 23rd floor. I told him we got to get out of here. We started walking down the stairs, we made it to the 8th floor. Big explosion. Blew us back into the 8th floor. And I turned to Hess and said, this is it. We're dead. We're not going to make it out of here. I took it.
That's all I'm going to show. Barry Jennings, at that time, was Deputy Director of the Emergency Services Department of the New York City Housing Authority. Highly credible man, a very articulate man, who was interviewed many times subsequent to this. The gist of Barry Jennings' story is that he and Michael Hess, Corporation Counsel for the City of New York, went up to the 23rd floor of World Trade 7, which is the building he's talking about here. In other words, they went to the Office of Emergency Management, as they were supposed to do when there was an emergency in New York. He says they went up there very early. He thinks it was sometime just before or just after 9 o'clock in the morning. They got there and the place had already been abandoned, and someone on the phone told them to get the heck out of there as fast as they could, so they began running down the stairs to get out of the building. They made it to the 6th floor. Jennings says the 8th floor on this little clip, but he later clarifies and he said, no, we made it to the 6th floor when there was a big explosion, blew up the stairs, even blew up the landing he was standing on, so that he had to grab hold of the railing, pull himself up. They retreated to the 8th floor. They couldn't get down the stairs because they were blown out, and they were trapped there, and they thought they were going to die. They were saying their prayers. Hours later, well after the collapse of both towers, they were finally rescued by firefighters, and it was shortly after that that Mr. Jennings gave this little interview. Now, the gist of this is as follows. If he's right, there was at least one major, structurally significant explosion in the World Trade Center early in the morning, World Trade Center 7. I don't know whether that was an early and unsuccessful attempt to demolish the building, or whether it was the beginning stages of weakening the building so that it would come down later. I don't know. But that explosion did not exist, according to NIST. They are adamant that it did not exist. So what do they do to Mr. Jennings' testimony in order to deal with him? They change two major things. First, they say Mr. Jennings did not perceive an explosion. We've heard from Bob earlier this morning how much NIST hates explosions and how much they hate anybody who refers to them. Some of you know, I've now cataloged 155 eyewitnesses to explosions in the Twin Towers at the time they came down. I've published 118 of those. NIST waves them all away. People like you and me who perceived explosions, some of them were thrown 40 feet, some of them talk about seeing them tearing the buildings apart, they're all wrong. They're all wrong. What kind of a governmental system has been created where ordinary people can not only think, we can apparently not even use our five senses? We're all wrong. So it wasn't difficult in that light to dismiss Mr. Jennings and say he was wrong. He didn't perceive an explosion. What did he perceive then? Debris. Debris from the North Tower falling on World Trade 7. Confused him, and he thought it was an explosion. And that requires them to say that Mr. Jennings was also off by roughly an hour in his time. He thought he experienced that somewhere around 9:30, but actually it was when World Trade 1 came down at 10:30. Well, all I'm going to say is this. Mr. Jennings cannot defend himself or speak up for himself because he died on August 19th, 2 days before the announcement of the final NIST report. We don't know why or how he died, but he died. And in the meantime, until I see evidence to the contrary, I am going to believe his testimony. I'm going to accept that he perceived what he said he perceived at roughly the time that he said he perceived it. And that means there were explosions in World Trade 7. My friends, my time is up, and I am going to sum up my talk as I end with the five major points. There was widespread foreknowledge of World Trade 7's collapse. This foreknowledge is incompatible with NIST's collapse hypothesis. Therefore, NIST's hypothesis is wrong. The controlled demolition hypothesis is compatible with the evidence of foreknowledge. There is also witness evidence that supports the controlled demolition hypothesis. Thank you very much for your patience.
You've just been listening to the speech given by Dr. Graham McQueen, Canadian Professor of Peace Studies, at the March 26, 2011 conference called Investigate Building 7. And I want to encourage you to watch the collapse of Building 7 at least four or five times. That alone can have a profound effect on you. And you can do that by going to the website rememberbuilding7.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.